From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when we mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 14 of Little Brother, dated the 27th of July, 2001. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. Okay, my regular listeners know the drill by now. The opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of WRPI, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union. And if you would like to call in with your opinion, you're covered under that umbrella too. Please give us a call. Area code 518-276-6248 is the number here at the WRPI studios. As usual, we're going to start off with items that were submitted to the comp.risks news group. Got an item here from NewsScan. Derailed train cars burning in a Baltimore tunnel have seriously damaged the area's fiber optic cables, slowing internet service and other communications traffic in the mid-Atlantic states with a ripple effect across the country. WorldCom, PSINet, and AboveNet all reported problems with service, but said they have not yet been able to quantify the severity of the problems. Keynote Systems, which measures the website performance, said that the delay experienced by internet users was the worst it has ever seen. What we're seeing is a problem in the handshake between the backbones, which serve as the internet's infrastructure, said a Keynote spokeswoman. These backbone providers hand off traffic to travel between them across the country. Keynote reported major slowdowns as far away as Seattle and Los Angeles that may be attributable to the train wreck. Lawrence Kestenbaum submits that calendaring software plays a critical role in any sizable organization. Local governments in particular hold innumerable meetings, formal meetings of the local legislative body, of course, but also committee meetings, citizen board meetings, project meetings, and on and on. And many of those meetings involve members of the public or officials external to the organization. The county government in Ouachita County, Michigan, has about 1,300 employees. Most or all of the county departments use Netscape Calendar version 4.6 to schedule and keep track of meetings. One particular county department, the Drain Commissioner's Office, responsible for construction and maintenance of storm sewers and ditches all over the country, or all over the county, rather, holds many meetings with local officials and property owners to discuss proposed or pending drain projects. A specific employee who was responsible for putting these meetings on the calendar left the county's employment, and her account was deleted from the system. Here's the problem. All of the many meetings that she scheduled had also disappeared. As a direct result, the drain commissioner and other county officials who relied on automated calendar were not in attendance at meetings where they were expected, resulting in an inconvenience for the public and embarrassment for the officials in the county. Only then was this problem resolved, or discovered, rather. The number of future meetings that had also been lost was unknown. Asked if the deleted message could be retrieved from the backups, they said no, individual calendars couldn't be restored, only the entire system, which obviously would disrupt over 1,000 individual calendars. The risk? Calendaring software that doesn't recognize the likelihood of turnover among employees, including meeting schedulers, and that there are more stakeholders in a meeting than just the one person who adds it to the official calendar, and that the access to information and backups may be needed on a less than all or nothing basis. By the way, I do skip through these topics off of comp risks fairly quickly. However, if you would like to call in on any topic that I've covered or any topic that I'm going to cover, maybe you're psychic and you figured out what I'm going to say next. Ha, I fooled you. Maybe you're want to talk about some other technical issue. Please give a call. Area code 518-276-6248 is the number. Bloomberg Radio reports that Home Depot will do targeted mailing synchronized with tax refunds. Apparently, the tax refunds are being sent out in an order related to Social Security number. Home Depot has the Social Security number information for a number of their customers. So they will send out advertising flyers to their customers in Social Security number order, timed to be viewed just when the customer needs help deciding what to do with that refund check. Bob Van Cleef tells us that he's from San Jose, California, says the security service that monitors the building where he works recently upgraded the alarm monitoring software. The people from the corporate office arrived, installed the upgrades, and left. Unfortunately, while they were here, or there, they appear also to have deleted the configuration database and all backups, as the local people ended up manually re-entering all of the system settings for all of the clients by hand. A month later, the computer room air conditioning went out, and the over-temperature alarm did not go off. They'd forgotten to tell the computer to monitor that line. Fortunately, one of the staff walked into the room before damage was done. They tell that everything is now working correctly. Why am I still nervous? Okay, this one comes from Harry Irwin. He says, in 2001, I moved to the UK to take up a position as a senior lecturer of computing at the University of Sunderland in the UK. Today, I got the first bill for a credit card taken out fraudulently in my name back in the US. I was fairly careful about these things. I suspect this is the tip of the iceberg. The first step, of course, was to file fraud alerts with the three major credit bureaus. TransUnion was very helpful and even indicated that the incident I already knew about was the only one on my record. Experian was not as helpful. I had to provide an obsolete zip code to reach the point of actually filing the data they needed, but then they recorded my voice as I provided the rest. Equifax was hopeless. They couldn't handle UK rotary phone numbers, and they required a US phone number for contact purposes. They also had problems reading the Social Security number, and they finally ejected him from the system, requesting a letter with about 5 pages of miscellaneous details, some of which, a pay stub with the Social Security number, are simply not available in the UK. I filed a complaint on that with the Federal Trade Commission. Next step is a letter to the credit card issuer to follow up on my voice report. I suspect that my notary will be busy. Monty Solomon submits that major financial institutions routinely give out confidential customer account information to callers using security procedures that authorities say are vulnerable to abuse by fraud artists. Regulators and law enforcement officials warned 3 years ago that identity thieves and information brokers were tricking clerks into giving them access to individuals' financial information. The source for that is Robert O'Hara Jr., Washington Post staff writer from July 23rd. The writer, who identifies himself simply as Paul, writes, I'm a longtime customer in good standing with NICOR, a large natural gas utility serving portions of northern Illinois. I recently had my gas shut off, the meter locked, and the meter scheduled for removal from outside my house. Luckily, I was home when the NICOR technician arrived to haul away the meter, and I asked her to check the order. Armed with a telephone and an email client, I discovered that anybody can cut anybody else's NICOR service off by supplying either an address or a telephone number. One representative told me that requests for shutoff are honored immediately. To a degree, this is understandable. Fire departments must, for example, kill the gas to a burning building. But the ease with which a cutoff under far less threatening circumstances can occur is remarkable. To their credit, NICOR is investigating the processes in place that allow this. Their default for each account, for example, is not to password protect it, that is, mother's maiden name or some such checkpoint. Is this a software risk? I think so. Shutoff requests are keyed into a system with, under the veil of the skimpiest of verification. Systems with a screen pop, which display the telephone number of the caller, also act as a checkpoint. This system appears divorced from a screen pop function. In this case, the final checkpoint is an on-site technician who can only debug the problem if the homeowner happens to be in. That's the type of debugging I would expect from, say, Microsoft, not from the utility company. This one is sent to comp.risks by Graystreak, who says, Insight Magazine reports that since 1997, the U.S. Postal Service has been reporting innocent activity it deems suspicious to federal law enforcement officials. Evidence includes a training video with this chilling instruction, quote, it is better to report 10 legal transactions than to let one illegal transaction get by. The risks of a system that presumes guilt until innocence is proven are too numerous to list here, not the least of which is the impossibility of proving a negative. I did not intend this cash to be used for illegal purposes. A similar reporting system in the banking arena is known to generate a ratio of 99,999 false positives for every true positive. Yes, I do mean a ratio of 10 to the 5th to 1 errors to correct results. I can't imagine any other system in which that error rate would be acceptable. The information on suspicious activities is, of course, kept in a database controlled in secret and used for purposes no one is willing to discuss. The post office will not discuss the parameters used to flag suspicious activity, although the video states that unwillingness to give out personal information such as date of birth and or produce identification papers is automatically suspicious. Would somebody please help me verify that I am still living in America? Has this submission. He says, recently my wife needed to redeem U.S. Airways miles for a ticket on short notice. The fee for the last minute booking was $75, which I paid with a credit card at the airport. When the credit card bill came, there were two charges for the $75. The U.S. Air representative I spoke to cheerfully reversed one of the charges and explained that due to a known programming error after the card was swiped, the record of the transaction was not cleared upon completion. When the next customer's card was swiped, the last transaction in the system was processed again, resulting in the double billing. He explained that all of this to me so that I would not be concerned about seeing somebody else's name as the passenger on the confirmation letter that would be sent. Sure enough, the letter arrived with the name of the person whose card was swiped after mine. One has to wonder how long this error has been known. Listening to Little Brother on WRPI Troy. Going to take a minute here for a quick break. Little Brother will return momentarily. You're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. Okay. Some of you will remember from last week that I made a brief mention of a case involving a Russian computer programmer by the name of Dmitry Sklyarov. Works for a company called Elcom Soft, and amongst other things, he wrote some software that breaks the encryption on PDF files. And what happened is this particular programmer, who, by the way, he is Russian. He works in Russia. But he came to the U.S., and he gave a presentation at a hacker convention called DEF CON. And as he came off the stage, he was arrested for violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And one of the things that seemed particularly heinous about this arrest is the fact that Dmitry actually did not carry out any crime under the DMCA or otherwise on U.S. soil. So I believe that the federal government is a bit out of their jurisdiction on this one. However, I do have some new information on this one. The first item I have here is a press release from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Adobe Systems Incorporated and the Electronic Frontier Foundation today, this was on the 23rd, jointly recommended the release of Russian programmer Dmitry Sklyarov from federal custody. Adobe is also withdrawing its support for the criminal complaint against Dmitry. EFF praises Adobe for doing the right thing, said Shari Steele, EFF executive director. We are pleased to see that Adobe has lived up to the high standard of integrity that has made the company successful. While we don't agree on every detail of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, we look forward to working together with Adobe to secure Dmitry's immediate release. We strongly support the DMCA and the enforcement of copyright protection of digital content, said Colleen Puglio, Senior Vice President and General Counsel for Adobe. However, the prosecution of this particular... The prosecution of this individual in this particular case is not conducive to the best interests of any of the parties involved or the industry. Elcomsoft's advanced ebook processor software is no longer available in the United States, and from that perspective, the DMCA worked. Adobe will continue to protect its copyright interests and those of its customers. Sklyarov was arrested on July 16th on a criminal complaint filed by the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of California under the DMCA. Elcomsoft is the Moscow-based company employing Sklyarov. So, anyway, if any of you have an opinion on that, I'd like to hear it. Phone number here is area code 518-276-6248. And I have another item here on that same issue. This item, let me see, where did this one come from? This came from The Enquirer, www.theenquirer.net. An interview on the Elcomsoft site in Russian has revealed a close relationship between the firm whose employee was put in jail Monday and the FBI. According to the Russian language interview with Alexander Ketilov, president of Elcomsoft and an ex-KGB operative himself, his firm had performed work for the FBI itself. An Enquirer reader has translated the interview for us, the original of which can be found on the Elcomsoft website. Let's see. They were asked how Dmitry was arrested. He was saying that on Sunday there was a DEF CON conference. Dmitry had delivered the ebook security theory and practice presentation on Monday morning around 9 a.m. I stand corrected about that detail. He was checking out of the hotel together with another employee, and on the way out of the hotel, two individuals stopped them. They presented their FBI IDs and immediately handcuffed Dmitry. Detained, the employees were put into separate rooms. With Andrei, they interviewed him for just half an hour, asking what and how he was, and he was allowed to leave the building right after. He tried to get me out on the phone, but could not get through, so after he called our Moscow office at around 9:30 a.m., this is Alexander Ketilov speaking, Moscow had already notified me via email about his arrest. They were asked him if Dimitri was the sole advanced ebook processor program author. And Alexander's response was, naturally, he is not the only one. Moreover, he was developing the scientific part of the program, its algorithms. The work is a part of his dissertation. There were at least three employees working on the program. The program itself comes under the Elcomsoft brand. However, it seems that the Americans are trying to present the situation as a hacking conducted by a single Russian hacker. So does it look like Dmitry was detained only due to his DEF CON presentation? Probably yes, was the response. Though he introduced himself as an Elcomsoft employee, the company that developed the product. Asked Alexander what the lawyers are saying. Our lawyers were notified on arrest in the evening when everything was closed down already. That's how it was developing. After I received the email, I called the Russian consulate. They prompted him to wait till noon at the consulate, assuming that the Americans would let Dmitry board the flight en route to LAX, where Aeroflot might bring him back to Russia. But he did not show up at the airport, so the consulate initiated a standard official request to American authorities. They spent around 2 hours on that, and we realized that Dmitry will not fly for sure. In fact, that we didn't even know where Dmitry was physically located. About 2 p.m., the request was filed, but not until the end of the working day. Till 6, there was no answer. So, on Monday, we had no info. Tuesday morning, when our office had started its new working day in Moscow, Dmitry's wife called in. She said that she had a call from the U.S. and via an interpreter was told that her husband was under arrest. She was not allowed to talk to him directly. This U.S. call was about 4 a.m. Moscow time, so it was Monday around 3 p.m. here in the U.S. So this meant that the authorities had not responded to the request filed by the Russian consulate on Monday. At any rate, if you want to talk about that issue, I'd love to hear from you. The number here is area code 518-276-6248. If you want to talk about that topic even after I've moved on to the next one, please feel free to do so. If you want to talk about any other topic I've covered tonight, even if I've just touched on it briefly, feel free to do that too. In the meantime, this song seemed rather appropriate. You're listening to Little Brother. listening to Little Brother. And I spoke to a few people before I came here tonight, and I had promised I would cover the topic of Microsoft Windows XP. What I have here in front of me actually is a complaint that was filed, a complaint for an injunction and a request for investigation and other relief that was filed with the Federal Trade Commission. It was filed by the Electronic Privacy Information Center and a number of other parties, which I don't want to get into all the details of who all is in there. For those that may recognize the acronyms right off, the CDD, CD, CME, CPSR, CFA, EFF, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of people listed in this particular complaint. But I did want to read to you some of the juicier bits from this, which I think my listeners will find interesting. I'm not going to read the whole thing. The thing is 20 pages. You know how legal material reads. But it says like this. As is set forth in detail below, Microsoft has engaged and is engaging in unfair and deceptive trade practices intended to profile, track, and monitor millions of Internet users. Central to the scheme is a system of services known collectively as .NET, which incorporate Passport, Wallet, and Hailstorm, that are designed to obtain personal information from consumers in the United States unfairly and deceptively. As is set forth in detail below, Microsoft has developed technical capabilities and business practices that facilitate such tracking, profiling, and monitoring in an unprecedented manner. As a direct result of these capabilities and business practices, Internet users who seek to engage in online commerce will routinely disclose to Microsoft virtually all aspects of their private transactions with other merchants. Internet users will also be confronted with a confusing labyrinth of interconnected Microsoft websites that collect and share their personal data. Consumer confusion is exacerbated by the misleading registration practices, incoherent privacy policies, and covert data sharing arrangements that are intended to facilitate the collection of personal information from consumers by Microsoft while simultaneously making it difficult, if not impracticable, for consumers to exercise control over their personal information. With the release of the new operating system, Windows XP, and its associated services, Microsoft will transform the process for the collection and the use of personal information on American consumers who engage in electronic commerce on the Internet. Personal information associated with commerce, such as credit card numbers, has traditionally resided under the personal control of the individual consumer. Such information is typically disclosed in the context of a particular transaction for a particular purpose to a particular merchant. With the release of Windows XP, Microsoft proposes to move the focus of control away from the end user to Microsoft. Although it is described by Microsoft as user-centric, the Windows XP architecture is more accurately described as Microsoft-centric. The Microsoft Passport is a user authentication standard that will enable Microsoft to collect personal information from customers and disclose that information to Microsoft partners and others. It makes Microsoft the central repository for routine information for commercial transactions, as well as personal facts such as birth dates and anniversaries. And of course, as many of you know, put a birth date together with a mother's maiden name, and you can pretty much work your way into your credit history or into anybody else that carries your credit information. This information is not really all that terribly secure. But back to the filing here. According to Microsoft, Microsoft Passport allows consumers to create a single sign-in registration and electronic wallet that can be shared between all of the sites that support Microsoft Passport. The information that may be stored in Microsoft Passport includes real name, country or region, state, city or locale, gender, age, occupation, marital status, email, personal statement, hobbies and interests, favorite quote, favorite things, such as name your favorite books, artists, places, gizmos or gadgets. A personal photo, include a photo of yourself, a loved one, favorite thing, or pet, and a homepage, options to routinely disclose the public profile in MSN chat rooms, and to be notified of future features, as well as whatever additional data Microsoft eventually chooses to request from the public public profile. The information maintained in the Passport public profile is under user control in the same sense that the user may choose not to provide certain information or to prevent certain information from being routinely disclosed, but the profile is also very much under the control of Microsoft in the sense that the information is physically in the possession of Microsoft. The Microsoft Passport privacy policy contains a section titled Participating Sites Commitment to Privacy. The title of this section reasonably would lead a consumer to believe that what the heading implies, that sites that participate in Microsoft Passport have a commitment to protect users' privacy. However, the section only contains one requirement for participating websites, and that is that all websites participating in the Passport program must have posted a privacy policy. Nothing is said regarding what the level of protection that policy is that must provide. This section, with its deceptive title, is likely to promote consumer confidence in Passport by instilling the mistaken impression that participating websites will protect their personal information. The Windows XP operating system leaves the user with little choice but to employ Passport. As soon as the user starts a computer and uses a modem, a dialog box appears on the screen stating, "You've just connected to the internet. You need a Passport to use Windows XP internet communications features such as instant messaging, voice chat, and video, and access to net-enabled features. Click here to set up your Passport." The collection and use of detailed personal information in this fashion constitutes an unfair and deceptive trade practice. Hailstorm is a software-based means to transfer personal information contained in the Microsoft Passport, as well as a host of other information across any operating system, platform, or device. Microsoft lists an extraordinary range of consumer information that will be collected and subsequently disclosed by means of Hailstorm. This information includes a person's home telephone number, office phone number, fax number, home address, business address, and geographic locations, a person's actual name, nickname, birth date, anniversary, or other special interests, and a personal photograph, complete list of all the names of all contacts contained in an electronic date book, including names, addresses, contact dates, and personal details for all friends and associates. Information concerning location and contact information, all forms of incoming mail, including voicemail, electronic mail, and fax mail, tracking information, personal and business documents, favorite websites and other identifiers, receipts, payment instructions, coupons, and other transaction records, device settings and capabilities across all platforms, including PC, PDA, and telephones, and detailed usage reports for each one of these services. Microsoft represents that when using Hailstorm, the user owns the data that he or she enters into Passport. Hailstorm will, according to Microsoft, put people in control of their own data, because Hailstorm starts with the assumption that the user controls all personal information and gets to decide with whom to share any of it and under what terms. Despite these broad representations, the control that users will ultimately have over the extensive collection of personal information within the Hailstorm system will be subject to the vagaries of Microsoft's business model. To use Windows XP, consumers will be unfairly led to believe that they need a Microsoft Passport. Passport is the basic user credential of Hailstorm. Although Microsoft claims that the user owns their information and that the consumers will control the use of that information, Microsoft will charge consumers to relay this vast amount of information, individually identifiable information, ranging from their home addresses to the documents stored on their computers. Microsoft will also charge recipients to use the information. They get you coming and going. As a result of these practices, Microsoft will essentially provide consumers the right, quote-unquote, to buy some limited level of quote-unquote control over the use of their own personal information outside of Microsoft, despite the fact that the consumer has no meaningful or effective control over the use of that information within Microsoft. Additionally, in reference to third parties, consumers' control of their own information exists only so long as the consumer's desire fits the framework of Microsoft's intent to contractually bind licenses regarding the use which they can and cannot make of this information. Microsoft's Windows XP Passport Hailstorm business model constitutes both an unfair and deceptive trade practice when considered in its entirety. Microsoft represents to consumers that the product activation feature included in the new Windows XP operating system and its software suite Office XP will not combine the information gathered in the activation's hardware suite with personally identifiable information. Information at the Microsoft website reads, "Microsoft product activation is completely anonymous and no personally identifiable information is collected." However, Microsoft then goes on to say, "Activation is different from product registration." If they wish, consumers may voluntarily register their product by providing their name and contact information. Registration is for those customers who want to receive future communications on product updates, services, release, and other special offers. Microsoft also claims the product registration, which requires personally identifiable information, is voluntary. However, users cannot receive support services for products without registering for Microsoft Passport. The user's product identification number is then linked to his or her personally identifiable passport information. Information posted by Microsoft states, using the online support sites secured by Passport is easy. Passport provides secure authentication, ensuring that your support interactions and all data exchanged with Microsoft is secure and private. To establish your own private and secure personalized support webpage where you can interact with our award-winning Microsoft support professionals, first-time users will need to first sign up for Passport or sign into Passport and second, complete a profile. You know something, actually, on an aside here, I'm going to take a wild guess that Microsoft's award-winning support professionals are probably receiving their awards from Microsoft. That doesn't exactly instill me with confidence. I continue. In order to identify the type of support you're entitled to, the system may automatically determine your product identification number. This number is required to receive support from Microsoft. Through product activation and registration, Microsoft can actually match users to their machines, and although Microsoft represents to users that the product activation process preserves anonymity, users cannot receive support anonymously for the product that they activate and are forced to register for Microsoft Passport. Now, here's where it starts to get juicy. Users of Hotmail email service are required to create Passport accounts using the personal information they provided to sign up with Hotmail. No notice is provided to Hotmail users that they are being given Passport accounts, nor does the Hotmail website contain an opt-out feature. When Hotmail users log into Hotmail, they are simultaneously logged into the Passport system. Passport will track Hotmail users as they visit other MSN sites and provide users personal information to those sites, unless the user clicks on the small sign-out button on the page each time they wish to move to a different MSN site. Hotmail's privacy policy states in part, your non-personally identifiable information from your Hotmail registration, such as zip code and gender, may be shared with other Microsoft websites to provide a more personalized advertising experience online. For example, you may see ads from a Microsoft Central Link Exchange Banner Network member as you surf the web, but none of your personally identifiable information is shared with the third-party websites. Passport tracks the behavior and divulges the personal information of Hotmail customers who neither have been notified of their Passport accounts nor have granted permission for such use of their information. If a user visits the MSN homepage, a Passport sign-in button will appear. If the user who did not come from Hotmail or another MSN site clicks on the same button, information on Passport will appear along with an invitation to join the Passport system. However, if a Hotmail user who did not click the Passport sign-out button before exiting Hotmail visits the MSN homepage and clicks the same button, the MSN page will reload with a message greeting the user by name. I'm going to skip ahead of quite a chunk here. Microsoft is aware of significant risks that users will have their personal information, including their credit card numbers, disclosed to others when the Passport service is used at a shared or public terminal, which could include a computer at a library, community center, workplace, or airport lounge. Microsoft advises you should always sign out of Passport when you are finished browsing the web to ensure that others cannot access your Passport profile or wallet. Microsoft is also aware of significant risks that users will inadvertently disclose personal information when they surf the web using the Passport service. It says, quote, it is important for you to read the privacy statement and terms of use for each site you visit to ensure you are comfortable with how they might use your personal information. Of course, the point that's missing there is that by the time you get there, if you are signed into Passport, that information's already been passed. Internet users are routinely unaware of website privacy statements. According to one recent study, 41% of users report that they never heard or hardly ever read privacy statements online. The failure to establish adequate security standards to ensure that personal information within the control of Microsoft, such as credit card numbers, is not inadvertently disclosed to a third party is an unfair and deceptive trade practice. Microsoft has a history of privacy and security failures that is inconsistent with its claim that any information provided to Microsoft remains secure and private. For example, in August 1999, when Passport was combined with Hotmail, A defect was discovered in the Hotmail that allowed anybody to read the private correspondence of about 50 million subscribers. In February 1999, Microsoft was found to be quietly creating a vast database of personal information about computer users. The online privacy seal organization TrustE subsequently found that Microsoft had compromised consumer trust and privacy. Defects in Microsoft software are routinely discovered that allow intruders unauthorized access to files. More recently, a defect in Microsoft's IIS web server software that has allowed the Code Red virus to compromise an estimated 300,000 computers, including some of Microsoft's own servers. Okay, Walter S. Mossberg is a widely regarded commentator on the computer industry who writes a regular column for the Wall Street Journal. On July 5th, 2001, Mr. Mossberg examined the product activation procedure for Windows XP and noted that Windows will keep monitoring your setup to check it's still running on the same machine. If you make major hardware changes, the system could disable Windows and force you to check in with the Microsoft in the mistaken belief that the program has been transferred to another computer. One journalist reported that his copy of Office XP suddenly went into reduced functionality mode and insisted he activate again while he was using it on an airplane. Microsoft has chosen a method of enforcing its policy that smacks of an invasion of privacy. The company says its database of PC configurations won't contain any personal information and will be encrypted so that nobody can misuse it, but Microsoft's bully boy behavior in the marketplace hardly inspires confidence that it won't somehow exploit this information. Stuart Alsop is a widely regarded commentator on the computer industry who writes a regular column for Fortune magazine. In an article for Fortune on July 23, 2001, Mr. Alsop examined the impact on Windows XP on consumer privacy. He found, for example, that when he tried to take advantage of a new consumer product, the ebook offered by a non-Microsoft company, he was required to go through the Microsoft Passport registration procedure. "I decided to buy the ebook," he says, "but Microsoft forced me to register with its Passport service in order to activate the reader. The ostensible reason is that Microsoft keeps track of digital rights to each copy of the book." He had a similar experience when he attempted to download a new software product. Based on his experience with these two products, Mr. Alsop observed, "Microsoft is going to collect more and more information about what I buy and what I do. I don't really have a choice. It's nearly impossible to use any computer without using Microsoft software, and increasingly that means that it is very nearly impossible to avoid handing over your personal information to the company. And this situation is just going to get worse because Microsoft does have a monopoly, and it is using that monopoly to aggressively expand its dominance of computers, personal computers, office servers, handheld computers, even set-top boxes, and its dominance of the web and web services delivered through its Internet Explorer browser." And I am going to have to break it there because of the fact that I disagree with that statement. I myself use the Linux operating system, and I know there are other operating systems out there as well besides Microsoft Windows for the PC platform, and I know there are platforms other than the PC, for example, the Macintosh. And I don't agree with the statement that Microsoft is a monopoly. I agree with the statement that I dislike them intensely. I agree with the statement that they are bullying their customers. I agree with the statement that they have brainwashed the American public into believing that they are the only game in town, but they are not the only game in town. Anyway, quickly to finish up the items on this complaint. "This gets to the heart of why I'm really starting to worry. Microsoft is encroaching on the consumer side, increasingly using its position between us and every computer to make sure that it has the data to know who we are and what we're buying." Esther Dyson is a widely regarded computer industry expert and chairman of Adventure Holding. Regarding the privacy implications of the practices described herein, Ms. Dyson said to the Industry Standard, a leading industry magazine, "I don't want the government or Microsoft asking me for my ID. I find it kind of amazing. You sit and think, can they actually do this? Is it believable? One hopes not." So I'd like to hear your opinions on this. If you have one, give me a call. The number here is 518-276-6248. I've played this next song a number of times, but I think the message is important. Make sure I got the right song that I'm thinking about here. Yes. This is The Clash on Little Brother.
This is a public service announcement with guitar. Know your rights. All three of them. Number one, you have the right.
Listening to WRPI Troy. We have a caller on the line here. Let me see if I can get him here. Wayne, are you there?
I am here.
Hmm.
Hello?
Hey, there you are.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Not a problem.
Technical show having technical difficulties. Go figure. So you were talking briefly about your thoughts on Windows XP.
Yes, I mean, if they are willing to provide the software free, they can do all the watching they'd like to do. But if I got to pay $100 to $200 for each copy of the software every 1.5 to 2 years, then by golly, leave me alone.
Well, it really doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I would agree with that. You would think that they would want to, if they want to collect all of this information, that they would compensate you somehow for it. And I agree. A free operating system would be one way to compensate you for it. I personally, under those circumstances, probably would feel the same way I do now. I am, as I've mentioned on the show many times and before, I'm a Linux user. So I try to avoid the Microsoft hierarchy as much as I can. I can't avoid it at work. The company I work for, like so many other companies, is all Microsoft oriented. But at home, every computer in the house runs Linux, and that keeps me out of this particular hole.
Well. Let's see, 3 out of 4 computers have Linux as an option.
Okay.
At home.
And so that puts you in the same well, working towards where I am, because I understand where you're coming from. I ran a mixture of Linux and Windows NT for a while myself, but I've never been really impressed with the scriptability or the automatability. I like to automate things. We'll put it that way. I like to automate things, and Windows NT kept getting in my way, and that was the thing that primarily drove me away from it. But when you have it snooping on you like this, yeah, that's just not something I can live with. And as I had read near the start of the EPIC's complaint there, they were saying that that they're basically charging you money to take this information from you, then they turn around and they charge the recipients money to give them that information. These guys are experts at getting you coming and going.
Oh yeah, I agree. And I started with the Office 2000 because I've already run into that where I my machines are in a constant state of metamorphosis. So I may have a processor in for 6 months and decide I want to change the processor or change the motherboard or change the hard drive or change something. It's always changing. And I've had to call in like 3 or 4 times already to reactivate the software. And I did complain bitterly because it's just a pain in the neck. And I call them at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I would imagine it's an even bigger problem with a laptop computer, because when you take the computer out of its docking bay, bam, the configuration changes. You put it back into a docking bay, bam, the configuration changes again. And laptop computers, of course, have got the PCM CIA cards on the side. Oh, just an aside here. I don't know if you've heard this one or not. PCM CIA, that stands for People Can't Memorize Computer Industry Acronyms. but they've got these they call them also more commonly PC card. And they're these hot pluggable devices that you can slide out of the side of your computer when you're done using it without even shutting the machine down. You slide another one in. Hey, guess what? Your configuration just changed.
Oh, wow. Never thought about that very much.
Yeah, exactly. And if Microsoft is sitting there watching your configuration in order to try to clamp down on piracy, they're going to be slamming some genuinely innocent people. It kind of goes back to near the start of the show. I don't know if you were tuned in for this one or not. Near the start of the show, I had mentioned something that the U.S. Postal Service was doing. They have a training video that they pass around that says that it's better to, let me see, what was the verbiage they used? It was better to falsely report 10 incidents than to let one legitimate, what was the exact phrasing? It was better to falsely report 10 legal transactions than to let one illegitimate transaction go through. That's the prevailing attitude that we're dealing with here.
Well, Microsoft has a lot of smart people working for them, but there's a lot more smart people out here. And my observation, just from the behavior of people in general, the more clamps they put down, the more people are going to purposely pirate their software just for spite.
Well, you got a good point there. It's a challenge.
There's always somebody that can figure out how to get around their system.
And I think that one of the other points that Microsoft has missed very largely is that one of the things that made their system so popular to begin with was the fact that somebody got it, somebody else looked at it, said, "Wow, that's cool. Can I have a copy of that?" And that is how the system got entrenched in the first place. That's how Windows 3.1 got entrenched. That's how Windows 95 got entrenched. I would imagine that there was still an element of that going on with Windows 98.
Well, it goes on with every new operating system they bring out. I mean, let's face it. If you purchase operating system A, mm-hmm. 18 months later, operating system B comes out. If you haven't seen it, you have no reason to want to buy it.
You got a good point there. actually, along those same lines, I have to wonder if we want to jump back to Linux for a second. I find myself wondering if this is going to be the thing that that gets Linux to come in and take over, is the fact that Microsoft is now clamping down on the piracy, and that it fails every time you change your video card. Whereas what I'm thinking of is Linux not only doesn't bother to check how many times the configuration has changed. I mean, yes, it does check to see if it's changed, so it can load the right drivers, but it doesn't, if it hasn't changed, it's not checking to see how many times it's changed, so it can shut down on you. And the thing of it is, the piracy is a non-concept because it's an open source operating system. It is a freebie, and as such, there's no incentive to have this sort of nonsense built into the operating system, and people can take it and copy it without having to go and justify in the back of their mind, well, I'm only ripping off a major corporation. Because when you do take a copy of Linux, if somebody sees Linux and says, wow, that's cool, can I have a copy of that? There's no rules being broken.
Yeah, exactly. Besides the fact it's free, which is much more to my economic liking.
Well, a low price tag is always a good thing. There's
the
no
thing
question
is
about
too,
that.
That it's accessible to people who are very unfortunate in the financial area, whereas those people can't afford Windows. Anyway, you shake it. But the thing is that honest people generally tend to stay honest. And if they see it and they like it, they'll buy it. Dishonest people tend to stay dishonest, and no matter what you do, they're going to find a way to get it and do whatever they want to do with it.
You know,
but
the
thing that really bugs me is this part you read about the Hotmail and the passport, which actually I was not aware of.
Oh yeah, they've been extremely sneaky about all this.
You know, I mean, I spend all kinds of money for firewalls and all kinds of stuff to try and keep people out of my business.
Absolutely.
And that's really annoying, and even more annoying that they're making more money on top of, you know, they're almost like Solomon as it is, throwing silver out as a dung heap because it's it's of no value to them.
And really, you've hit on exactly really the reason that the thing that triggered me to play that last particular song, because one of the rights I think that people have is an absolute right to privacy of their own affairs.
Unfortunately, in America, it seems like that right is rapidly disappearing.
It is.
Social Security numbers, for instance, I thought were a private issue, and nowadays it doesn't seem any longer to be so.
Well, the thing of it is, I guess the way it came about is that you needed a unique identifier for all of the various databases, and that was something that was unique to each and every American, so it basically became a natural. At any rate, I'm up against the clock at this point, Wayne, so I'm going to have to let you go. I thank you for calling in, though.
You're welcome, sir.
All right. I look forward to talking to you later.
Long live Linux.
All right. You take care now.
See ya.
Okay, and we are up against the clock. DJ Toast is up next, and he's in the house and setting up, so I'm going to let you go with this. You've been listening to Little Brother from the studios of WRPI in Troy.
My